MacCast, Thursday, May 30th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. Well, another great week in Apple and Mac news. We've got a bunch of great stories to get into this week. We've got Tim Cook, who is at the D conference, and we will find out what he did or didn't say. He said some interesting things. Will WWDC be just about the software, or does it have more? Johnny Ive has seen Apple's new world, and apparently it's flat. And forget about the low-cost iPhone. There is actually a new low-cost iPod Touch. We have that, plus we'll chat about the rumor crazies who start to pop up as we get late in the rumor cycle. Also look at how to find open files using the terminal and see if Siri can be our lady luck. We have that and a whole lot more, but before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is GoToMeeting by Citrix. You know, the people we work with most aren't always the people that we see on a regular basis. Often these days, we have coworkers who are on the go. Maybe they work in different offices, remote locations. They can be spread out across the country, maybe even across the entire planet. And to work efficiently, you really need to have a strong connection with your team. You have to build trust. You have to stay focused. You have to do brainstorming. You do have those times when you need to get together. And that's where GoToMeeting with HD Faces can really help out. It's a powerful and very simple way to hold meetings online and to see each other face to face. With GoToMeeting by Citrix, your team is literally just a click away. It's simple as clicking a link, and you can not only have a face-to-face call, but you can share your screen and collaborate in real time. They give you a bunch of powerful tools to make the whole process much more efficient and much more effective. You just turn on your webcam and immediately you're online meeting with HD video, so it literally feels like you're in the same room. And you can launch and join a meeting from practically anywhere. You can use your computer, you can use your smartphone, your tablet. You can even actually present from your iPad. I've had GoToMeeting for a few years, and it is a valuable tool for my business. I can't imagine not having it. I have clients all over the country. As a matter of fact, all over the world. I have clients in Australia. And the amount of personal interaction that GoToMeeting lets me have is really, really valuable to my business. Not all my clients are technical. As a matter of fact, most of them aren't. That's why they're coming to me. They want me to handle all of the technical stuff. So I need a collaboration solution that is really, really simple. And GoToMeeting does provide that. I just send them an email. It has a link. They click it. And that's it. In a few moments, they're in my meeting, they're on my call, we can share video, we can share documents, we're connected, and we're collaborating, and that is really important to me. And when I do need to get a little more technical with what I'm talking to them about, the screen sharing feature lets me show them documents, lets me show them interface elements, lets me actually demonstrate how to do things. They can see it right there on their screen, and that really eliminates a lot of confusion. It eliminates a lot of miscommunication, saves me time and money because I'm not having to go back and forth through emails and other things. We can get it all done on one GoToMeeting call. And they have apps for your iPhone, your iPad, even your Android devices. So it makes it really easy to hold a meeting when and where you need to do it. And so I think you really need to try GoToMeeting. And you can do that free for 30 days by taking advantage of my special offer. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. That's GoToMeeting.com, and enter the code MACCAST. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. And a big thank you to my sponsor, Citrix, for their support of the MacCast. Tim Cook was the keynote interview that kicked off this year's D11 conference. That's the conference put on by the Wall Street Journal's All Things Digital and hosted by Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher. Try as they might, though, the hosts couldn't get Tim Cook to open up about the details on Apple's future products, software, and services, but the interview did still manage to turn up some interesting stuff that I wanted to talk to you about. Starting with the Apple TV, Cook reiterated that this is an area of quote-unquote incredible interest for Apple and that they do have a grand vision for television. Beyond that, though, Tim Cook simply spoke about the success of the current Apple TV product and why Apple hasn't moved into the TV space yet, at least alluded to that. The Apple TV has managed to sell 13 million units to date, which is an impressive number, and Cook said that half of those units were actually sold in the past year. So as a hobby, I would say the Apple TV is impressive. That might be an understatement. As a matter of fact, Philip Elmer DeWitt of Fortune did some math after the interview, and he came to the conclusion that Apple controls about half of the digital media receiver market. Now, his numbers did exclude gaming consoles like the Xbox or the PlayStation, but still impressive for Apple in the TV space, even without a true television product, just a set-top box. Tim Cook simply said the device has proven more popular than Apple had thought, and that's likely one big reason why he keeps referring to television as an area of interest, or now incredible interest for Apple. He also alluded that for Apple to enter the television space, they would need to bring the consumer a TV experience that's up to date and create an experience that consumers actually love, something that he said current products are really failing to do. They then moved on to the subject of wearables. As a matter of fact, it seemed to me like they really just couldn't bring themselves to actually ask him if they were doing an iWatch. He simply said that that area was interesting and that the trick, according to Cook, was to create a product that a person who doesn't already wear that type of product would want to wear, specifically referring to something that would go on the wrist. I think it was a watch he was talking about, but he mentioned his Nike Fuel Band and some of the other fitness product, wearable products that are currently out on the market. He said he sees wearables as another branch of that post-PC tree and commented that Apple does still really believe in post-PC in a big way. He commented on the explosion of the sensor market as well as it relates to wearables, things like the Nike Fuel Band. He commented on the explosion of the sensor market as it relates to wearables. Didn't really comment on specific things, but I'm assuming he meant fitness products, medical monitors, environmental monitors, essentially all these things that manufacturers seem to be creating to hook to smartphone applications to actually do a lot of the monitoring and reporting and give us an interface for. He said sensors are all over right now and there's lots of experimenting going on, but really no one's developing the kind of integrated cohesive products that I think Apple might be apt to do. And while he avoided coming right out and saying that Apple was working on wearable products, he did say that overall, with the arc of time, the future of these kinds of products would become clear. Cook also commented on his philosophy about Apple's market share, or actually Apple's philosophy on market share. And I think there's nothing really new here. Basically, market share isn't a driving force at Apple, according to Cook, nor is it something that they really worry about on a day-to-day basis. He simply reiterated that Apple wants to create products to enrich people's lives. He said that's what we're all about. And he said that where he tries to focus his looking at Apple's success is on stats like usage and customer satisfaction. He sees those as more important markers of Apple's success than how many units of a product that they sell. As to what's coming next, well, he did let a little bit of information out, but was pretty tight-lipped. He confirmed that at WWDC, it would be about the future of iOS and Mac OS X. He also said that there would be a focus on developers, stating that Apple owes the world to them. And I felt that was something that was really good to hear. It's one of the big wishes that I have for WWDC is that Apple reaches out to its developers who I think have had sort of not failing relations, but troubled relations with Apple in the past few months, specifically when it comes to a lot of their services products, things like iCloud and Siri. I'm hoping they're going to give them some tools and some additional APIs and ways to integrate that stuff that are much easier and makes Apple's products and can make Apple's products a lot more cohesive, especially on the services side. He didn't announce any specific products, and no specific products were discussed. That's not a big surprise, but he did go over sort of what I would call the philosophy of what's coming. He said that there is going to be an incredible focus on hardware, software, and services, and that it's the combining of those things, so you can't tell the difference between one or the other, sort of where one starts and one ends, that is a focus for Apple. He called that actually the magic that is at the intersection of those three things. And I felt that was a very Jobsian style statement, just how he delivered it. If you go and listen to the interview, you'll see it was sort of almost like he was channeling Jobs at that moment. I think this is a lot of what we've been talking about on the show, something I actually covered in detail on the latest MacCast members show, this seamless integration of Apple services into the mobile operating system and the desktop OS. I think it's going to be key in Apple maintaining its technological lead of the market and really showing other companies the future, something that Apple classically tends to do, but something that more recently Google has been extremely good at as well, especially on the services integration side. And so I think Apple either needs to amend things with Google and start to reintegrate some of the Google services into Apple's products. That would let Apple focus on what they do well, hardware and software, especially user interface and user interaction, and then hook it up to really solid, robust services. I don't think that's something they are going to do, however. I just want to make that statement right now, but certainly a direction they could move in. I think more likely what Apple is going to do and what we'll see at WWDC is them really double down and focus on making their services the best in the world. And not only that, but having this seamless integration with the operating system, with the hardware across their entire lineup of products, not just one of them, but really getting to this point where that Tim Cook was talking about in the interview about one sort of morphing and merging into the other. To do that, they have a huge task ahead of them, but really I'm looking for some glimpses that they're working on that at this year's WWDC. And it's going to be things like iCloud syncing. The documents in the cloud service needs a ton of work. The opening up of Siri and its services and integration, especially with third-party apps, location and maps, that needs to come way up. Apple also needs to do more in the social space. I'm thinking that's going to happen more with partnering with companies. We've heard those rumors about more Flickr and Vimeo integration coming in at least the next version. And the one big wild card, in my opinion, is really search. I'm not sure how Apple is going to integrate search, where they're going to get those search services. Maybe that's something that they will continue to integrate from Google, but it's probably going to be the biggest and hardest area for Apple to expand in and integrate, at least if they want to go without a partner, if they don't want to sort of bury the hatchet with Google and move forward, if they want to do their own thing. I don't know where they would get search services. Yahoo is a potential possibility, but I'm personally really unsure about that at the moment. It seems like an interesting idea, but I'm not sure it would be the best move for Apple. I think they want to stick with the best in business services, and I think on the search side, that still is Google. But we'll have to see, and Tim Cook, again, did not comment on any of these specific things. It's just something that I started thinking about after the interview. And in closing, talked about the sort of three things, the three most important things he thinks about as he's running Apple, his sort of philosophy for running the company. And first and foremost, he said it was about making great products, also making sure that the culture at Apple stays the same, and fighting against any of the things, any of the forces that might seek to change that culture. So really, overall, pretty good interview. Again, not a lot of details in terms of what Apple's going to do, but that's something that you're not going to get from any interview with a CEO or actually any executive at Apple, but still some very interesting nuggets and sort of glimpses as to how Tim Cook thinks on a day-to-day basis about running the company and about maybe the philosophies behind some of the future products that Apple is working on and intends to deliver to us. So that interview from the D conference happened last week. It's now available. The full thing is available on the All Things D website. But if you have an Apple TV, and I almost forgot about this till the last minute, but if you have an Apple TV, there's actually a Wall Street Journal channel. And I went into mine and checked, and they do have the full interview available on that. So you can watch it on your big screen. And that's actually how I went through the thing. It runs about an hour and 20 minutes. So grab some popcorn and be prepared to sit down and have a long conversation with Tim Cook. But I think it's well worth checking out. In a completely different kind of interview, Tim Cook was up on Capitol Hill recently and gave some testimony on the Senate about Apple's corporate tax strategies. But during that, an interesting little tidbit came out, and we got some more details about the future of the U.S.-made Mac. He said that Apple does plan to begin manufacturing a Mac here in the United States. That news wasn't new, but he went on to reveal that the manufacturing would actually take place in Texas. A couple weeks ago, Apple said it would be making a $100 million investment in domestic manufacturing. And prior to the location confirmation by Cook at the Senate hearing, there were rumors of various U.S. sites where the new Mac could or might be made. And Texas was definitely one of the locations mentioned, but we did not know for sure. We now know that Texas is the site, but we don't have a specific city, so we're going to have to wait for that information. As far as U.S. manufacturing goes, Apple actually already does have some limited assembly of iMacs in the U.S., both in California and Tennessee. They do that through their partner Quanta. And as far as Texas goes, Apple does have an administrative campus there. As a matter of fact, the campus, which is in Austin, is being expanded, and it is said to be becoming a main operations center for Apple's American operations, handling logistics for North, Central, and South American Apple partners. The campus in Austin also contains R&D facilities that are used for work on Apple's A-series processors. The Austin R&D makes a whole lot of sense because Apple also manufactures their A5 processors in Austin using a facility that's owned by Samsung. Apple's manufacturing partner Foxconn also has facilities in Texas and Houston, but I haven't heard if there's any Apple work done there. I was trying to do some research and I wasn't able to uncover anything. So if you happen to know, shoot me an email and let me know. But if Apple does decide to use Foxconn as their U.S. manufacturing partner, it could be Houston. That is the city where that Mac is made. Apple hasn't said specifically which Mac model is going to be the U.S.-made Mac. There are some indications that it could be an iMac because Apple has done some iMac assembly in the U.S. It also could be that rumored Mac Pro that Tim Cook said was coming sometime this year. But another interesting thing is that Apple has also said that many of the parts for the U.S.-built Mac will be sourced from U.S. suppliers, they said, in places like Arizona, Texas, Illinois, Florida, and Kentucky. And while so far I've really kind of believed the rumor that Apple would be making the Mac Pro here in the States, maybe even the Mac Mini, Corning is actually in Kentucky, Corning Glass Company, and that's where Apple gets the glass for their iPads and their iPhones. So the fact that they are going to have a U.S. supplier in Kentucky makes me start to think Apple could be looking to have a product that is going to feature glass, and Corning could be that manufacturer. So that pushes me away from Mac Pro or a Mac Mini, unless there's some sort of radical redesign in the Mac Pro and it's going to have some sort of built-in screen or a touchscreen. I guess they do use some glass on the trackpads, but I don't know if Corning actually supplies that. But that pushes, if it is Corning who's supplying some of the component parts, then that would push me more toward an iMac or a Mac Pro. Who knows? And we really won't until Apple and Tim Cook come out and actually tell us which Mac is being made in the U.S. Whichever Mac it is, though, one thing that is looking like a distinct possibility is that it would feature next-generation Wi-Fi. A Chinese website posted images of what they say is the next-generation gigabit 802.11ac component for future Macs. The component has 802.11ac and Bluetooth 4.0 on a single chip, and it supposedly looks like the connector could even be backward compatible with the latest Macs that Apple has out on the market today. If the connection turns out to be exactly the same like the images seem to indicate, that could mean that we could see some third parties offering aftermarket updates for recent and current MacBook Pros and iMac models. And even if not, at least future Macs are believed to have the new 802.11ac technology. Many think that because in recent updates to the operating system, specifically betas of 10.8.4 Mountain Lion, there have been references to the new, faster 802.11ac Wi-Fi. The 802.11ac Wi-Fi specification is actually in its final stages. It hasn't been standardized yet, but it's not uncommon for new Wi-Fi components and routers and things to ship before the standards are actually ratified. A lot of the late stage changes that might happen in the specification can actually be addressed with firmware updates, so I don't think that would stop Apple from putting the technology forward in new Macs. As far as what gigabit Wi-Fi promises, it promises speeds of up to 1.3 gigabits per second using a 3-antenna design, and it's fully backward compatible with the current 802.11 standards. It's also said to offer a wider coverage range and also better battery efficiency, both things that Apple would be very interested in. And so I think there's a very good likelihood that we will see 802.11ac being the standard that Apple supports in future products, especially since we're not expected to see any hardware products from Apple till sometime in the fall, and that should give the specification more time to kind of reach a more complete stage. And I would expect by that time, too, we'll start to see some components, routers, and other things that are coming on the market to help support the standard. And of course, if Apple does support 802.11ac in their Mac products, I would expect them to update their routers, the AirPort Extreme and AirPort Express base stations as well with the new technology. I guess not releasing any new hardware products for the first half of the year might have a slight impact on Apple's sales. Yeah, who knew? Well, I think we actually all did, but KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo actually has some numbers this week to back it up. In a report to his investors, Kuo said that he expects overall iPad sales to decline 10 to 15% year over year in the second quarter. And that translates to a quarter-to-quarter drop of about 20 to 25%, so fairly significant. As to why, Kuo is citing two main factors for the drop: the rise in cheap Android tablets in the market. Consumers literally just have more buying options this year. As a matter of fact, IDC said last quarter that Apple's tablet share dropped down to 40%, even while overall they sold 65% more iPads than the year before. The trouble was that Samsung's tablet shipments were up 283% and Asus's were up 350% from a year ago. I do want to point out, though, that Apple is one of the few companies to report unit sales that match with their unit shipments, whereas competitors just report unit shipments, not actual units sold. So there's some variance in the percentages, but you can't argue that 283% and 350% rise from a year ago is much larger than a 65% rise in shipments. And that translates to just more tablets on the market, more buying choices for consumers. And thus, when Apple's not releasing a new product for 6 months, they're going to see a decline in their unit sales. Quo also said that supply chain checks show about a 40% drop in iPad mini shipments from last quarter. So mini sales are on the decline, or at least Apple's expecting to not need as many minis. You could look at that a couple different ways. It could be that they finally caught up with demand and they're reaching more of a stasis. I think that's more likely what's going on than Apple is actually going to sell fewer iPad minis in the quarter. But again, the second quarter also tends to be a little bit lower just in terms of overall sales. It's that lull in the market before we get back to school and get back into the holiday season in the fall, which is a big reason why I think we're hearing Apple is going to sort of backload their products into the back half of the year. And so I don't really find the numbers declining being a big story here. The percentage is pretty drastic, but I think Apple is really going to bounce back when they start putting out new products in the fall. As far as how the second quarter is going to look in terms of units, Quo talked about the iPad. He thinks Apple's going to sell around 12.7 million iPads for the quarter, and he breaks that down into 6.2 million being iPad minis, 4.5 million being iPads with Retina displays, and around 2 million being the older iPad 2. He doesn't specifically mention the lack of new iPads in the marketplace as a driving force for the declining quarterly sales, but he does say that he expects iPad shipments to jump back up to first quarter levels in the third quarter if and when Apple introduces new models. Possibly to help those slumping sales numbers a little bit, Apple did lower the price of refurbished versions of the iPad mini and the iPad with Retina display in their online store this week. You can now get the models for about 15% off of what you used to be able to get them for. The mini 16GB Wi-Fi is now selling for US$279. A 32GB Wi-Fi model will run you $359, and the 64GB model $439. And again, these are the refurbished models available on Apple's online store. The refurbished iPad with Retina display also got a price drop. They are now available online for $419, $499, and $579 for the 16, 32, and 64GB models, respectively. The cellular models are available at $529, $609, and $689 for the same respective storage sizes. Again, refurbished models on Apple's website. They have not dropped pricing on the new models. With WWDC coming up in just about a week or so, many of us know that WWDC tends to be focused on software and developers, but will it bring a little bit more, possibly a MacBook update? There are reports now that some retailers are starting to run low on stock of MacBook Pros. That sometimes is an indicator that Apple's looking to refresh the lineup, and so Apple may have a surprise announcement at the show. The belief is that Apple may update the line to feature Intel's latest Haswell processors, and if so, the new MacBook Pros could have significantly improved graphics performance along with battery life. According to Apple Insider, some of the processors in the Haswell lineup feature a new integrated Iris GPU that Intel designed to compete with the NVIDIA GeForce GT650 chips, which are currently found in the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro models. The higher-end integrated Iris graphics aren't in every Haswell processor, but will be featured in the higher-end quad-core designs that Intel is shipping. And currently, Apple does use the quad-core Intel processors in the MacBook Pros, specifically the Retina MacBook Pros. So it's safe to assume that if Apple does upgrade to Haswell, the MacBook Pros will get the Iris GPUs. Even if they don't, the lower-end Haswells also have updated processors. Those would likely be the chips that would be featured in Apple's computers like the MacBook Air. Intel will use an Intel HD Graphics 500 chip in those units, and Intel says that offers about a 50% improvement over the current Intel HD 4000 chips. That's what's currently in Apple's lineup in terms of integrated processors. The Haswell is also designed with power savings in mind. According to Intel, they said the focus was on notebooks and tablets. Intel claims that the designs offer about a 50% longer battery life in normal operation, and they say that they will last 20 times longer when in standby mode. The Retina MacBook Pros already come with a 6-hour battery life. That's real-world battery life as tested by a number of different websites. If they do get a 50% increase in usage time, that could be huge. With double the battery life and about 3 times the graphics performance, the new MacBook Pros look to really raise the performance bar again for Apple. The question is now, will we see them in the next few weeks? What we are expected to get a glimpse of is the next generation of iOS, iOS 7, and this is going to be the first one that is going to have the mark of Johnny Ive on it. As a matter of fact, 9to5 Mac's Mark Gurman said last week that Apple's senior vice president of industrial design, Johnny Ive, has made his mark on the upcoming iOS and that that mark is flat. His sources describe the new interface design as black and white and flat all over. Basically, they're going through and exercising any of the heavy textures, color palettes, design flourishes that are currently present in a lot of Apple's apps, that skeuomorphic design, as many people refer to it as. It's also being said that the icons for Apple's applications are going to shed their glossy, sort of buttony look for a more flat design as well. The Notification Center, Apple is said to be testing, also apparently has more widgets, or at least they're playing around with widgets. Those are similar to the weather widget that we have now, but they're looking at things like localized news feeds, also possibly Wi-Fi airplane mode and Bluetooth toggle switches that would be available from the Notification Center interface. I know that's a popular hack for jailbroken iPhones. There's also been some hacks just for non-jailbroken devices that Apple's shut down for actually toggling those kinds of features on and off. So it makes sense that Apple might be experimenting with that. The home screen is also said to possibly get support for panorama style wallpapers. Apparently, the way these would work is that as you swipe between the different screens on your home screen to access your different applications, the backgrounds would actually slide along as well, allowing you to set a panorama photo as your background. And with Apple having a panorama feature built into the phone for taking pictures, it makes sense. You could take a nice panorama shot and then use that for your wallpaper and get to experience the entire image as you're swiping through your home screen. The apps themselves are said to be getting a more uniform look with a lot of white backgrounds and flat textures. The main differentiator between the applications is going to be, I guess, a unique accent color, something that would be featured in buttons and kind of give you a sense of which application or which family of applications you're in. For example, they might use red for the calendar application, green for messages, blue for mail, a lot of the colors that we familiarize with the icons for those applications. So kind of carrying that through. But overall, any heavy textures, things like the green felt that we see in Game Center, the wood shelving that's in Newsstand right now, those are all expected to be removed completely, along with any kind of embellishments that aren't part of the UI, things like the torn paper edges, all of the stitching, all that sort of real world, trying to simulate an actual item kind of touch that we see. And that's because Johnny Ive has commented on several occasions that he thinks that those kinds of things date the operating system. They sort of set it at a point in time. I think that a lot of the kinds of updates we saw in Apple's podcast app, where it lost the reel-to-reel tape interface and a lot of the UI elements came forward and became sort of flat elements, I think we're going to see that across the entire Apple lineup. The main difference we're hearing in these latest reports, though, is rather than using a dark design, it's really going to be a lot of white, a lot of open space, and really just colors kind of accenting the different areas. As for any kind of major feature enhancements, we aren't hearing much about that at this point, but I do expect big things at WWDC. Apple should at least reveal about 10 of those. That's typically what they do, is they'll show us 10 new features that are in the OS. So far as the rumors go, we've only heard about third-party service integration, things like Flickr and Vimeo. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. Also, we've been hearing rumors of deeper in-car support for things like Siri and Apple Maps. The only bummer there is that's typically going to require you to purchase a new car. So open up your wallets if you want to gain access to those new features. But it makes sense that Apple wants to have better car integration with their iOS devices, and apparently they're working with auto manufacturers to try and make that happen. Any new hardware really isn't expected until the fall. We mentioned possibly some new MacBook Pros, but the new iOS should release along with the new devices, so I expect we're only going to get a little sneak peek as to what's coming in the future OS, and that will give developers some time to learn the new features and work on that in preparation for a fall release of the software updates. It's going to be interesting to see if Apple sticks with a yearly update for OS X. They said that they were moving to yearly updates, so that would put an update to Mac OS X 10.8 coming out in the summer, but it sounds like Apple might be a little bit behind on that, and maybe we won't see that until the fall either, but we are also expected to get just a preview of the next version of OS X at WWDC. We've been talking for a really long time now about the rumors of Apple releasing a new lower-cost iPhone, and that iPhone should come available in different colors, but we've not really talked too much about which specific colors Apple might be releasing. Well, the Japanese blog Mac Takahara claims that their sources are telling them that the new low-cost iPhone will come in colors, but they can't seem to agree on exactly which ones. One source claims that the colors will be navy, gold, orange, white, and gray. The others claiming that it will be white, pink, green, blue, and a yellow orange. The yellow orange could maybe translate to gold and orange. Maybe there's some crossing over there. But they seem to both agree that black is not going to be an option on the low-cost iPhone. They didn't talk about what the materials are, but we know from earlier reports that speculation is Apple will use colorful rear shells made of polycarbonate plastic. That's to keep the price point down, and many are expecting the price to be as low as $99 to $149 US. Now, the report does go on to contradict an earlier Mac Takahara report on exactly when the new low-cost iPhone would appear. In the past, they were saying we wouldn't see that unit until 2014. Now the site seems to be falling more in line with other sources that are looking for a fall release. The site says the low-cost iPhone production is set to begin in July, with a release possibly happening around the September timeframe. Mac Takahara has been historically hit or miss on Apple rumors, and they also did comment a little bit on maybe some of the future updates for the iPhone 5S. They're saying it might possibly be available in three colors: black, gold, and green. They don't say anything about the white, and this idea of a gold iPhone, I think it was kind of triggered by what was reportedly a component part leak of a SIM tray adapter that looked like it was gold or almost a beige. I think I commented on that on a past MacCast. In my mind, I think that might just be a raw unfinished metal, or maybe, I don't know a lot about anodizing, maybe that's a color, a base color for metal that could be used before it actually gets its anodized color applied to it. I just really don't think Apple's going to do a gold, quote-unquote gold iPhone. It just seems gaudy to me and really not within Apple's design style. So these rumors are kind of falling apart for me at that point. I do think a low-cost iPhone in colors is definitely possible. As far as the iPhone 5S goes, they also commented on the EyeSight camera. They say that it might be getting a dual LED flash upgrade. If someone could write in and let me know who knows about this, what's the advantage of a dual flash versus a single flash? In my opinion, the flash on the iPhone is worthless. I don't care if you have one LED or two LEDs. It's just too bright. It's not even something that I ever use. It just tends to wash out my photos. So I'm not at all excited about an LED flash update. They also say that the rear mic on the iPhone would change its shape. Right now, it kind of has an oval pill shape. That would be moved to more of a round shape. So couple iPhone 5S rumors, some interesting low-cost iPhone rumors in terms of color, but, you know, who knows? We're not going to know anything until Apple actually releases the products. And again, that seems to be happening in the fall. I hate to keep reiterating that, but that's all we're hearing at this point. And then finally in the news for this week, and what feels like it could be a prelude to a new low-cost iPhone, Apple this week replaced the low-cost last year model of the iPod Touch that they've been offering on their site with a brand new low-cost iPod Touch with 4-inch Retina display. The new model is priced just slightly higher, about $30 US more to be exact, at $229. It looks identical to the current generation iPod Touches with some significant modifications. It has the same 4-inch Retina display and a dual-core A5 processor, but there's no EyeSight camera on the back and no loop strap attachment. That's that little pop-out button on the lower corner that allows you to attach a wrist strap. It's available only in one size, 16 gigabytes, just like the prior low-cost model, and available only in one color, the silver and black, so doesn't have that range of colors that the new iPod Touches have, but it is the same form factor and same design styling. Apple also announced that to date they've sold 100 million of the iPod Touches. That's since they went on sale in late 2007. And I would assume with a little minor refresh to the low-end model, they're hoping to sell a few more. And the iPod Touch wasn't the only Mac product to get a low-cost update this week. Apple now also offers a sub-$1,000 entry-level MacBook Pro, at least if you're in the EDU market. They lowered the price of the entry-level non-Retina MacBook Pro for education from $1,099 US to $999. They also dropped the price of the $1,499 model, the 2.9 gigahertz one. You can get it for $200 off the standard retail price as well for $1,299. Again, that's if you're in the education market. One thing I didn't check and is likely to also have occurred is that the government market can get the same sorts of pricing. Apple typically prices products for military and government employees at the same discount as they do for the EDU markets. I apologize for not checking on that before I started recording the show, but you might want to go take a look at that as well. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Starting off the feedback, commentary, and questions section of the show, I want to talk a little bit about the rumor mill. You know, rumors have been on the rampage. This happens when Apple kind of has a lull between their product announcements. And often as we get toward the back half of that time frame, eventually what I call the rumor crazies start to come out. We start hearing all sorts of weird things from rumor sites that pop up that often we've never heard of before, and they just start saying just odd things. So I didn't feel I could really report this as quote-unquote news, and I'm relegating it to the commentary portion of the show, so we can at the very least look, point, and laugh at these rumors. First off, we have the Chinese blog WePhone, which we have heard from in the past. They say that their insiders are telling them that the display on the iPhone 5S is going to pack in twice as many pixels, but not change in terms of size. That would be 1.5 million pixels to be exact in the same form factor. At that point, we're getting down to pixel sizes where you can't even tell the difference. We're already at Retina, the average person can't tell or distinguish pixels, and going even higher just seems crazy. There's no reason to do that, at least if you're not going to increase the physical size of the display. We know that there's higher pixel per inch and higher resolutions on some of the Android phones, but they also have larger screens, the 5, 5.5, moving into the 6-inch range. If this rumor is true and the display remains at 5 inches, it's unclear how Apple would actually mash in all of those pixels. Mac Rumors did a little bit of speculation, and they said one way Apple could do it would be to up the density by a factor of like 1.5. That would give the new display a resolution of 1704 by 960 pixels, according to their calculations. They say that would be 1.6 million pixels in the display, and a display density of about 489 pixels per inch. Again, the human eye is not going to be able to see that, and so you're going to add processing power, you're going to reduce your battery life for almost no benefit. Some think that Apple does need to have a 1080p or better display, something in the 400 pixel per inch range. That would be to keep up with competing devices like the Samsung Galaxy S4, which has a resolution of 1920 by 840 and 441 pixels per inch. I think Apple is just not about playing that game. Tim Cook talked actually in the D conference about other factors that go into Apple's decisions on what kind of display they would put into their products. It's not simply pixels per inch and resolution or size. It also has a lot to do with the quality of the display in terms of the color, in terms of things like performance when it comes to battery life and display quality. And so they factor all those things in. And he did sort of allude that Apple would do larger screen devices when some of those trade-offs might go away. And another problem with moving to that high of a resolution and staying at the same form factor would be scaling of applications and interfaces. It would create more work for developers, and I think at this point that's not something that Apple wants to do. They tend to want to stick to even translations, so twice the resolution, not 1.5, so that developers don't have to develop all these crazy resolutions. Another problem that's often cited on the Android side of the house as a challenge for developers, and one reason why developers may avoid developing for the Android platform. Apple does not want to get into that massive number of multiple resolution display game. I think it just creates a nightmare. The other crazy thing that we're hearing is that Apple is planning an iPad Maxi for release in 2014. I don't even know where to start with this one. The name, maybe. There is no way that Apple is going to market a Maxi Pad. This one actually came out of Korea from the ET News. They say that Apple is talking to display manufacturers and other component suppliers in Korea about producing a 12.9-inch display for future iPads. They rationalize it by saying that Apple wants to create devices that are going to compete with the small notebook and ultrabook markets on the PC side. The thing about it is that Apple already has the best ultrabook product on the market in the MacBook Air. So that's not something that I think they're going to try and create an iPad to compete with. It just seems completely crazy. I'd actually put more stock in Apple looking at manufacturers for creating a 12.9-inch, about a 13-inch touchscreen for maybe a touchscreen MacBook product. But I think even that's crazy. I'm not a huge fan of touchscreens on actual notebooks or desktops. I think it's just a weird form factor. Maybe they're working on some hybrid designs. It could be that they're in talks for early stage parts for doing some R&D, maybe some alpha testing of products, but I highly doubt that Apple's looking into doing a 12-inch or a 13-inch iPad. I just don't think there's a market for that, at least not at the moment. So see, the rumor crazies are starting to come out, and I would expect, since we have a lull before the fall, that we're going to hear a lot more of this kind of crazy kooky talk. Jason is a fairly new Mac owner. He came from the Windows side and is actually new to the Mac community. So welcome, Jason. And I got an email from him this week about mounting drives, and specifically the whole approach that Apple takes that's a little bit different than Windows about ejecting drives before you actually close up your Mac, put it to sleep, and, you know, disconnect it and take it off somewhere. So if you're using a notebook, you want to make sure that you go in and eject your drives. Otherwise, you get that little error message, right? And Jason, being from Windows, he's new to that whole experience. I actually covered this back on the May 1st show, the actual reasons and this difference in philosophy between Windows and Mac. So Jason, if you missed that, you might want to go back and listen to it. Maybe you heard that already. I think I get this inkling that you probably did, because your specific question relates to something that we talked about on that show. But just to catch people up, I want to say the short answer is that Macs and Linux use something called write caching on external drives, whereas Windows doesn't. And basically what write caching does is it improves performance by not writing files, especially small files, to the drive immediately. It uses some caching when you're actually doing a copy operation. So it'll do the copy, let you get back to work, and then sort of finish up in the background. And because of that, it requires you to eject your drives before you actually, you know, take your Mac away to avoid any potential corruption. If you just were to yank the drive out, you don't know if there's actually a write operation happening to the drive at that moment. And that, if you pull a drive while it's actually writing, that can you risk getting corruption on your drive, and that's something you don't want to do. On Windows, it doesn't really warn you, so you still have this chance, if you're not safely ejecting your drives, if you're just yanking them out, that you could get corruption. On the Mac, if you do this, and I'm sure all of us have done it at one point or the other, either you forget to eject the drive or you're just not thinking about it, you'll get that error message that pops up that says the disk was not ejected properly. Don't do this. You could get corruption. So you're not guaranteed to get corruption. And as a matter of fact, I think our friend John Foster, who used to do the NoTech show and actually is a big member of the MacCast community, especially on the forums, really smart guy, he used to say something along the lines, and I know I'm getting this wrong, John, maybe you can email me and tell me the exact quote, but basically, real men don't eject their drives first. I mean, you can pull them out. As long as you know you're not nothing's writing to that drive, you can go ahead and yank them. You're probably not going to suffer any ill effects. The problem is that there's no indication within the operating system whether or not you're writing that drive or not. And especially with solid-state drives and flash drives and things like that these days, some of them don't even have lights to indicate that any kind of write operation is happening. So you just may or may not know what's going on. So really, you don't want to eject any drive from any system. Even on Windows, it's generally a good idea to use the safely removed drive option. A lot of Windows users don't even know that that's there. If you see the external volume down in the system tray, you can right click on it and there's a safely removed drive option that will eject the drive, and then you can yank the USB cable. So that's the absolute safest way to go about it. Now, Jason wanted to make things more convenient on himself, and I mentioned a utility in the May 1st show called Jettison. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com this time around too, but in essence, what this does is it sits and it watches your Mac and ejects any volumes when your Mac goes to sleep. So if you close the lid, it will automatically eject your drives. That way, if the lid's closed, if you just want to grab your laptop and go, you don't have to worry about manually having to go through and eject any of those external drives. The trouble is that that software will not necessarily auto-reconnect those drives when you wake from sleep. So you'll need to unplug the drive and replug it back in to get it to mount back up on the desktop. And the trouble with that in Jason's case is because he's using Time Machine, and one of those external drives is his Time Machine drive, what's happening is Jettison, when the Mac goes to sleep, is ejecting the drive or unmounting the drive. And when he wakes the Mac back up, that drive's not reconnecting. So that means Time Machine will just sit there. It'll wait until that drive becomes mounted and available again before it can do its thing. So Jason was looking for some sort of solution where it would auto-remount the drives when it wakes back up from sleep. Now, I was looking at the Jettison site, and it said that if you close the lid on your MacBook Pro and then reopen it, that those drives should mount. So I don't know if this is a difference between just letting the Mac go to sleep naturally through Energy Saver with the lid open, not triggering the remounting with Jettison, or if you actually just went ahead and physically closed the lid to put it to sleep, Jason, and then reopened it, if those drives would automatically remount. But really, Jason was looking for some sort of third-party solution, some sort of automated way to remount the drives. And I looked into this. I did not find a solution that I felt I could really recommend. I'll tell you about some of the solutions I found here in a moment. But Jason, for you, I would say just my recommendation, don't eject or don't have your Time Machine drive ejected. And unfortunately, again, looking at the Jettison software, I didn't see a way to specifically say, I only want to auto unmount these drives and not this one. But I leave my Time Machine drives connected all the time, and Time Machine works really, really well. It's not a whole lot of extra time to have to go through and just individually eject those drives. And I do know that one feature of Jettison is that you can go up to its icon and eject all your drives, I think, with one manual operation. So you might just use that feature of Jettison to manually eject all your drives all at once before you have to take your Mac and go someplace. That said, the solutions I did find are kind of hacked together methods using different monitoring applications and scripts. I'll have a link to all of these in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to dig in deeper. I found a couple good articles that walk you through the process. As a matter of fact, one of them had three or four different solutions. The main premise is to use an application like Sleep Watcher, which is a daemon that executes, runs in the background, and looks for when your Mac, or watches for you when your Mac goes to sleep or wakes from sleep, and then allows you to execute an automator or an Apple script to actually do something. So in this case, you'd create an automator or an Apple script to actually remount your drives when it sees your Mac waking back up from sleep. The trouble with this method is that it can change sort of the default way your Mac was meant to work, and it might cause some unintended side effects. One of the methods that I was reading about, it basically unmounts your drives. It doesn't actually eject them or fully eject them. And the side effect of that is it could cause your Mac not to go into standby mode. If you don't eject the drives, apparently it won't go into standby, something that you might want your Mac to do. So you can play around with this stuff. It's not a recommended method. And I think just sticking with the Apple way of manually ejecting the drives and then just quickly unplugging and replugging back in the USB cable to get them to remount, I think that's the safest way to go. But I'll let you be the judge of which solution you want to play around with. Just as an aside, because I probably will get some feedback on it in this, a lot of people often ask me about auto remounting network drives. So if you connect to network volumes at work, how can I get those to mount either when I boot up my Mac or when I wake my Mac back up from sleep? Sleep Watcher can also help you here, and there's an article, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, on how to set that up. I think an easier way, specifically if you just want to remount network volumes on startup, there's an easy trick that I've talked about in the past, but I'll fill you back in on here. You can mount the drive on your Mac as usual, the network volume, and then go into your system preferences, into the user and group preferences, and add that as a login item, that mounted volume as a login item. And if you do that when you boot your Mac, then it will automatically reconnect to that. If you save your username and password for connecting to that network volume in your keychain, in your Apple keychain, then it should auto mount and not hassle you at all. If you'd prefer to have the dialog pop up, then just don't put that stuff into the keychain. And when it tries to reattach to the network volume on startup, it will prompt you for that info. So once you're in the user and group preferences pane, you just go into your user account, go into the login items. You might have to click the little lock and authenticate so you can actually make changes. But at that point, you click the plus item to add an item to your login item list, and then just browse and select the mounted network volume or the network share that you're connected to. Add that to the list, and then the next time you boot, it will automatically log you into that network volume. So that's how you do that. And good luck, Jason, with your auto-mounting or remounting of your drives. I hope you find a solution that works for you and that this information helps you out. And thanks for the email, and thanks for being a member of the MacCast community. Now, here's a totally awesome terminal trick that I learned about this week. It'll allow you to show all of the files that are currently open by any application you're running on your Mac. And by all the files, I mean all of the files, and you'll see what I mean. If you open up your terminal and type the command LSOF, that's LSOF as in Frank, and hit return, what you'll get is you'll get a dump of all of the files that are currently open on your Mac and which applications they're associated with, not just the ones that you see on your desktop, but any files the system or the application might have open. That includes all kinds of internal files and stuff like that. Just try it out and you'll see exactly what I mean. It can be a little bit overwhelming, but you can see things like all the internal graphics files and plist files and resource files, data files, things like icons and UI elements. It's really kind of an interesting peek under the hood. So just from that standpoint, I think this is kind of a cool little trick. And be careful with this one, but what you can do is you can actually copy and paste one of those paths, say a path to a .tiff or a .pdf item, one of the graphic user interface image files for an application. You can take that, copy it out of the terminal, and paste it into the Finder's Go menu. So if you go under Go and choose the Go to Folder option, it allows you to insert a path. And if you paste that path in there, you can actually get a preview of an image that might be deep inside the bowels of a specific application. I was messing around with it, and I could get at the little icon files that are used in the menu bar, things like the Wi-Fi signal icons. Those will show up in this list. And so that's kind of fun to play around with. Again, be very careful with that. You don't want to modify or change or edit anything in any of those files, because that could break something on your Mac. use it cautiously, but it is kind of fun to just hack around in there. And I actually got this tip from Melissa Holt over at the Mac Observer. I'll have a link to her article in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. She posts a lot of really fun, interesting tips and tricks. And so if you haven't caught her articles in the past, you should follow those. But as far as what LSOF stands for, it stands for List Open Files, which makes a lot of sense. And rather than, if you'd rather not just dump a bunch of stuff, a little more useful tip, and the tip that Melissa put in her article was that you can actually use this trick to ferret out a pesky file that might be preventing you from doing something on your Mac. How many of us have gotten that sort of dreaded pop-up message that says the operation can't be completed because the item, and it gives the file name, this file.jpg is in use. And you're like, well, which application is actually using that file? You can use this terminal trick, launching the terminal, typing LSOF, and then hitting a space and then dragging in the file that's referenced in the error message. So just find that file on your Mac, drag that into the terminal window. And what that's going to do, it's going to add the path to that file, the full path to that file, to the end of the command. So you'll have LSOF, a space, and then the path to that file that's causing you the issue in the terminal. Do that, hit return, and it will show you which application is actually using that resource. So then you can go quit that application, force quit that application, free up the resource, and then get past that error message. And this actually also works for figuring out why you might not be able to eject an external drive or external disk or volume also. But in the current, and that would have been more useful in older versions of Mac OS X. Actually, the current versions of Mac OS X will actually display which application is actually holding on to that file for you. So it's not really necessary to use LSOF in that case, but it's still a cool trick though, and one that I wanted to share with you. One of my very favorite features of iOS on my iPhone 5 is the dictation feature. I use it quite frequently, you know, bringing up the keyboard, tapping that little microphone icon next to the space bar, and then simply chatting away, and then tapping again when I'm done, and having it in a few magical seconds suddenly go boom and type out the text for me. That's amazing. That is magical. I love it, and it saves me a lot of time. Sometimes, especially on my iPhone, it can be really hard to type on that tiny little keyboard. I've gotten pretty good at it, but sometimes you just want to blurt something out and have it converted into text. And so I love that feature. But I guess, according to iMore, occasionally there can be some problems with that becoming unavailable. I have been lucky. I've never had this happen. But I guess in some cases, you'll go to use the dictation feature and that little mic icon will be grayed out. Pretty scary, right? I hope that actually never happens to you, and I hope it never happens to me. But if it does, never fear. The iMore site did have an explanation and a fix. I guess what's going on is that, especially in third-party applications like Twitter, that icon might become unavailable. It occasionally happens, I guess, in Apple's applications as well. But what's going on is that the memory on your iOS device has just gotten low, and when that happens, iOS turns dictation off. Now, I always thought that if you had an application in the background, if it was, you know, not the active application that was in use, that iOS would be smart and it could choose to sort of shut down some of the resources that that application might be using and make that available to an active app. But I guess I'm wrong on that. Either that or there's some sort of bug in iOS that's not managing that stuff the way that it should. I did read one piece about the memory that sort of said that really, if you have stuff in RAM and memory, it's going to stay there even when the application's in the background. So that might make the resources not available for the dictation program to work. Now, regardless as to the specifics of what's going on, the fix, I guess, for the inability to access that dictation feature is to simply shut down the application. So double tap your home button, bring up your fast application switcher, press and hold on an app icon until it jiggles and you see the little red close circles, and just start closing away. Shut down all those background applications except for the one that you're using. And then I guess once the resources are freed up, you can tap the home button, exit back to the application you were working with, and that dictation button should be returned to normal. You should be able to tap on it and start dictating away. Now, the iMore piece seems to indicate that they think this is a bug and something that they hope will be fixed in the next version of iOS, iOS 7. I'm hoping that maybe even it would be fixed before that. If Apple is aware of the issue, I don't see any reason why they couldn't put it in an iOS point release. Again, assuming that is actually a bug and just not a problem that Apple has with too many background applications storing stuff in memory and just not having the memory available. They would actually have to start going through and throwing stuff out of RAM, and that might not be something that you want the applications doing, because you could lose stuff. I guess they could maybe write it out to a storage area temporarily so that it could free up the RAM. Yeah, there'd be some ways to handle this, and maybe they could handle it a little bit more elegantly than just simply graying out your microphone icon, which for me would put me in a panic mode. And so I'm glad to know how to fix that should it ever pop up for me, and happy to share that with you. And thanks to iMore for pointing that one out. I think many of you also know that Siri is something that I really like in iOS, and I use it quite frequently. But every once in a while, I run across a trick for Siri that I was totally unaware of. And that happened this week when I was reading a Cult of Mac piece. They highlighted a really cool Siri Easter egg that I wanted to share with you. Did you know that Siri could actually roll a pair of virtual dice for you? If you activate Siri and say, roll the dice, she will come back with two numbers between 1 and 6. That could be pretty handy if you've lost the dice to your favorite board game, or maybe even if you want to play an impromptu game of craps. You can also use Siri to make a quick decision. Apparently, you can tell her to flip a coin, and she will tell you heads or tails. Another trick, also pointed out by Cult of Mac, I think a couple weeks ago, is that Siri can generate a secure password for you using Wolfram Alpha. So if you get to a website, you need to generate a password, and you don't have 1Password, I'm not sure why you wouldn't have 1Password at this point. Just an aside, a favorite application of mine and how I generate all my passwords. But just say you don't have 1Password around. You can actually activate Siri and say Wolfram Password or Wolfram Alpha Password, and she will kick back an 8-digit secure password along with some other kind of cool information. It'll give you the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot way of expressing that password. She'll also give you an additional 6 8-digit passwords along with the first one that she returns. This could be useful if you want to generate a even more secure password. Typically, I don't consider an 8-digit password to be the most secure. I prefer to use a 16 to 24-digit password. So you could just take the multiple ones that are generated by Siri and Wolfram and append them to each other to get a longer password that you might need. The only other thing I'll note is that the password does seem to be upper and lowercase alphanumeric characters only, so no special characters. If you want to put a special character in your Siri-generated secure password, you're going to need to add those ones yourself. But still, a couple cool tricks for Siri and just more usefulness that we can get out of it before Apple actually starts expanding things. Please, Apple at WWDC, I want to see third-party integration of Siri so that I can use her features and functionality even more. The other thing that I talked about on that members show is I would really like to see Siri get some of the Google Now style features where it's more preemptive, where she kind of anticipates more of my needs based on the data that's in my phone. So if I have an upcoming meeting, it's 20 minutes away and it looks like I'm going to be late, why can't Siri jump in and say, hey, I've looked at the traffic, you have a meeting in 20 minutes, you need to leave the house now? That would be totally awesome. And you can extend that out. There's lots of ways you can think about this, but you know, the ability to offer up a map or recommend a restaurant before I even have to hit the button to ask, that's some cool technology that Google is exploring, and I'm hoping that Apple will give us a glimpse of them exploring at WWDC as well. And then finally for this week, I have a trick specifically related to the MacCast, or a tip I guess I've been doing this show for so long, almost 9 years now, that I often assume that everybody knows how to get access to the MacCast show notes. And some of you may or may not know, I take pretty extensive show notes for the podcast, and I make those available for you to either look through, to reference, or even make a copy of if you like. You can get the show notes for the show both in an HTML format that you can view on the website at maccast.com. You can also download the OPML, the Outline Processor Markup Language format of the shows, and you can take that and import it directly into any kind of outlining app, something like Omni Outliner or Circus Pony's Notebook can parse that file, and you can have your own copy of the show notes that I use to produce the show. I also place a text version of the notes, in case you've missed it, in the metadata of the audio file that you download, the AAC file or the MP3 file, and many podcast players and apps will actually display that information for you, so you can actually peruse it right there in your podcast listening application. But if you want to get the full show notes from the website, either the HTML or the OPML versions, all you have to do is go to maccast.com, find the show post for the episode that you're looking for the notes for, and then if you scroll down kind of near the bottom of the post, you'll see a line that says show notes in, and then links for HTML or OPML versions of the show. If you want to download the actual OPML file, just control click or right click on the link and then choose the download linked file as option in Safari, or the download file option in, I think, the other browsers. I can't remember the specific language per browser, but if you control click or right click in the contextual menu, it should give you an option to actually download the file rather than to just view it in your browser. So if you'd like to do that, that's how you do it. And a couple people had asked me about, hey, how do I find the show notes at maccast.com? And so I thought I'd cover that in a little more depth. And with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for the iPhone and the iPad. You can check out all their software, as well as get free trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. All you have to do is visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, MacBook, Samsung Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth by going to gazelle.com. Squarespace, if you need to build a website and you want to do it fast and easy on an amazing platform, you should check out Squarespace at squarespace.com/maccast. That they allow you to easily create a professional web page, blog, online store, or gallery all on a single platform. You can try it free, no credit card required. Just head to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now, and you can save 10% on purchasing a new website when you use the offer code MACCAST5. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all of the hassle out of sending and sharing your business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP by using ShareFile. You can try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. That's ShareFile.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your feedback, especially your audio comments. You can attach an audio file, record it on your iOS device, use the built-in voice recorder application, and send all of that stuff to maccast@gmail.com. You can also use the voicemail hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, if you'd like to leave voicemail messages there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And as I mentioned, you can get show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, along with, you know, all of the stuff, all of the information I use to actually record these podcasts in full detail on the website over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's where you'll find John Foster and a bunch of other very smart folks ready and willing to help answer your Mac questions and give you advice and stuff like that. It's a really great resource. And if you haven't taken advantage of that, please do. It's totally free. All you have to do is sign up. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, you can check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. You'll also find me on Google Plus. Just look for Maccast. There's a community up there. And I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, that'll do it. And I will talk to you all again real soon.